The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
When I was here 2 weeks ago, I gave a talk about mindfulness, focused mostly on mindfulness of the body. But I talked about what's called the four foundations of mindfulness, could be seen as a four-step process of going inward into oneself, and deeper and deeper. And so the body, bringing attention to the body, is the outermost kind of layer, in a sense. It's the first, most obvious place, and then from there we go in. And so today I'd like to talk about the second step that could be said, kind of lightly, don't take me too seriously with the words, but going in. And this is what's called in Pali, vedana. And one way of translating vedana into English is translated as ways of knowing. Sometimes it's translated as feeling, and I guess feeling is a way of knowing. When you feel something, and you feel the blower, air conditioner against my skin, I know it. That's a way of experiencing it. So ways of knowing. So as introduction to this, when I was in India, I spent a little bit of time with a teacher named Munindra. And one of his memorable teachings is that if it's not simple, it's not mindfulness. And so he had encountered many people who heard the teachings or the instructions and somehow made it into an engineering project, made it complicated and became very thoughtful and analytical or different things. But that if it's not simple, it's not mindfulness. So then when I had my traveler's checks back then stolen in Calcutta in somewhat embarrassing circumstances, I went back to see him, and he said, "Gil, it's important to be simple, but don't be a simpleton." So to keep it simple. And one way I'd like to talk about is very, very, very simple terms, this practice, Buddhist practice, is to take recourse to the way that, so in meditation practice in Buddhism has two main components. It's mindfulness or insight, mindfulness and concentration. And then when they translated these Sanskrit Pali words into Chinese, sometimes they would translate those two things, insight and concentration, with the words, with the characters for stop and look. Stopping is the concentration, looking is the insight. And so it's very simple, just stop and look. I mean, your mother probably told you that. Stop and look. But to really do that a lot, and to do it as part of meditation, to stop the activities we're doing, where we sometimes are so busy doing things, or so involved in things, that we're not really stopping to really take in what's really happening here. To sit down and meditate and begin stopping the incessant chatter in the mind, swirling in the mind, so we can stop, and once we kind of stop, we can see what's here in a deeper way, in a clearer way. So we stop and to look. And as we stop, just sit down and meditate, sit and be quiet, one of the most obvious things you'll notice if you stop might be that you have a body. And tremendous emphasis in Buddhism on being present in your body, being mindful, being aware of your body. The body is a vehicle for deepening your practice. So we become aware of our body, stop. And then as we become more aware of our body, then the body becomes a means for knowing. And we can know things through our body. So, I mean, we already know that, I suppose. I mean, our senses are ways of knowing. We see. The eye see, and so we know through the seeing. We smell, and we know through the smelling. We feel tactically, and we know through our tactile sense. We taste, and we hear, and we know these things as ways of knowing. And then there's more subtle ways of knowing. In the body, through our body, or within this psychophysical body we have. We can get a lot of information about ourselves as we take all this in. One Zen teacher I studied with, he said the body is an antenna. And so you walk around with this antenna, And if you tune into it, you pick up a tremendous amount of information about what's going on inside of you, outside of you, your relationship to the world around you. And one of the great ways is if you feel subtly uncomfortable about something, someone's asking you to do something, and some feeling in your belly, kind of like something is off here, but your mind logically says, well, maybe I should do this person a favor or something, but something doesn't seem right. That can be a very good thing to stop and pay attention. Notice what that's about, that subtle knowing about something's not quite right. But if you're busy and lost in your thoughts and involved in the analysis and rather than feeling what's in the body, that information won't be available to you. Some people say there's intuition that we have, and so I'm not sure what that is. My definition of intuition is when the whole world helps us understand something. I don't know what it is. But there's all kinds of ways of, more subtle ways of knowing that seem to be much more accessible when we're settled and attentive to all the cues that are coming from our body. One of the things that Buddhists are fond to say, people who do mindfulness at least, is that all our experiences of the world around us, happens through our five senses, at least. So that, if we can be in very complicated worldly situations, but the raw data that comes in through our eyes, our ears, our nose, is then interpreted based on past associations, memory, assumptions, complicated mental processes, and it gets reconstructed into the event that we have. And it's relatively easy to point out how that's something our mind does. So, I mean, just for example, in this room here, we call it a meditation room, meditation hall or something, because that's often what we do here, is we meditate. Before we bought this building, this was a sanctuary for a church, and there were pews lined up here. And it'd be very funny if we all be sitting facing me because the pews face that way. And so it was a sanctuary, maybe similar in ways, but a different feeling, a different kind of idea. The rooms, the walls, so much of this place is the same as before, but because we use it as a meditation hall, we call it that. We could, when Liz Powell comes and does her Dharma Rocks here, her kids' programs here, it becomes a kids' playground. And it's kind of wild in here sometimes with the kids running around, and they love these zafus, these cushions we have, because they make castles and piles and they jump into them. And we've had music events here, so this is the music hall. We've had social events, social hall. It kind of changes. I've come in here and done yoga, but no one else is here. It's my yoga, private yoga room. So what this room is partly a construct of the function it has, but that is something that is not in the seeing of the room. That's, you see the sights, you see the floor and the walls and the chairs and the zafus, and then those sights come in, and based on our memory and what you've been taught, it gets constructed as a meditation hall in the mind. But the raw data for constructing the whole world comes through these five senses that we have, and then what goes on in the mind. So what happens if you start tuning in to how we know things at each of the five senses? This most simple, rudimentary place where it all begins. In some ways, you begin at the building blocks, and the bricks, in a sense, that are going to build the house. You start paying attention at the very beginning. Because sometimes if you go to the beginning of something, the beginning of where something grows, you can discover in that beginning how to be free or how to relate to it in a wise way. That's much harder if you get involved when it's already getting quite abstract and complicated, the situation. And so mindfulness practice has a lot to do with bringing the attention back to the building blocks, building it back to the origin where it all kind of begins, where it all gets created, so we can watch more carefully and notice what's actually, how we're creating, what's being built, how this whole magic show happens based on the raw, basic beginning of what we most fundamentally and directly know. So the Buddha talked about ways of knowing. In the second foundation of mindfulness, he talked about two general classes or divisions of ways that we can know. We can know based on the sense input that comes from the world around us. And we can know certain things that are not from the sense input from the world around us, but rather from the way that our inner life activates feelings, activates emotions, activates sensations within our body, independent of what's happening in the world around us. And so that division is a very important division in Buddhism. Because remember, I'm talking about a journey to go in to our depths. So to know what's happening in the experience of the world is still a little bit on the outer surface of things. But when you start going in and noticing more deeply what are the sensations, what are the senses, the feelings that arise that are stimulated by an inner life, then we're getting something that's more kind of closer to the heart, closer, deeper down. Yeah, can you following me a little bit? Okay. So ways of knowing. So these two ways. Both ways, to keep it simple, it said that you can know that it's either... these things are either pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. So when we take in the experiences of the world, take in the sense data, that data can come in and be experienced and be known as pleasant, or be known as unpleasant, or known as neither pleasant or unpleasant. So it may be a little boring to hear that. But this is really simple building block that experience at this very simple level, pleasant and unpleasant, before we kind of make a whole story about it, before we kind of make it a little more complicated. So if someone gently strokes my arm, that might be very pleasant. Someone like my son did today in the pool kicked me in the water, that hurt. You know, it's a pleasant and unpleasant experience. But it gets a little more interesting because if this person I find amazingly attractive, boy, just my dream person, wow, get hot just thinking about the person. No, I guess it's 82 here, maybe just the temperature. But anyway, this person comes along and strokes my arm. Oh, just, that's pleasant. Boy, but then there's my old nemesis, just a person who irritates me no more than anybody else in the world, and a person who never showers and never shaves and just slobbers and never cleans his hands or anything at all. Comes along, same gentle stroke, ooh, you know, unpleasant. Or that wonderful, attractive person comes, but, you know, I have certain ethics I'm supposed to follow, and, you know, this is kind of complicated now, and this is pleasant and unpleasant, and, you know, now it's all a struggle with what I'm supposed to do, and basically, don't do it. It's kind of too complicated. It's unpleasant. What I'm trying to say in my complicated way is that the pleasantness and unpleasantness of experience is not only inherent in the experience itself, but has something to do with associations we have, the meanings we have. Oh, I'll tell you a good story. The story that I heard about one of the great founding fathers, I guess, or characters for a part of Korean Buddhism was a man named Chindul. And he was going to study Zen in China. So he took a boat. He was going to take a boat from Korea to China. And on the way there, he got shipwrecked. And he made it ashore in the dark, in the rain, and crawled up, just exhausted, I suppose, and crawled up and onto the shore, up on top of the little plateau where it was safe, I guess, and crawled under a bush or a cave or something, and felt he was really thirsty after being in the ocean for a while. And he felt around in the dark, and he felt a bowl, And, you know, it had been raining and stuff, and the bowl had water in it. So he said, oh, how lucky. And he couldn't see. So he drank the water and felt very refreshed. And the next morning he woke up and found out that he was in a tomb or a grave or, I don't know, some kind of situation, and it was a skull. And he had drunk out of the skull. And so first he was horrified, but then he woke up. That was kind of one of his enlightenment experiences. And you can imagine that it was pleasant the night before when it was dark. And then when he saw what it was, associations and everything, then it became something else. So our mental capacity to interpret and react to our experience is sometimes very closely entangled with how we experience the world. So to come back and start noticing in any experience you're in, that things are pleasant, unpleasant, or neither, begins tuning in to, in a deeper level, what's going on with how we experience the world, how we are in the world. It also can make things a lot easier. I'll give you an example. If you're in a very difficult social situation, and whatever it might be, and because of a social situation, there can be a lot of complexity involved and a lot of problem solving and a lot of things that you have to decide maybe, or just there's a lot going on. And if you get caught up in analyzing and figuring out all the things that you could figure out in a social situation, you might be there for a long time. But if what you want is to find some ease in that social situation, just a little bit balanced, a little bit be free and not so entangled in it, some people find it very helpful to simply recognize this complicated social situation, it's unpleasant. And then I've known people who say, well, I know how to be present for what's unpleasant. It's just unpleasant. And some people find just recognizing, it's just unpleasant. Then they kind of relax and they step back and they're not so pulled in or entangled or caught in it. It doesn't mean that the problem solving necessarily stopped, but it's just unpleasant. As a parent, I've taken recourse to this little insight a fair number of times. It's just unpleasant. I can do this. I said to him, unpleasant, and I know it's not going to last. So, or same thing, pleasant. Oh, this is a pleasant experience. There can be a lot of wisdom to clearly recognize, oh, this is a pleasant experience. Because then sometimes if you see it as pleasant, maybe you don't lean into it or get as infatuated in the pleasant. It's just unpleasant. It's a beautiful quote from the Buddha. I like it at least. He said, someone who endeavors and practices, does not get entangled in suffering or pain, the same word, depending on the context, does not get entangled in suffering. And the person who practices does not give up or reject pleasure. Or it actually goes, the person who practices well does not get caught up in pain or pleasure, unpleasant, depends how you want to translate this word, dukkha, suffering, the unpleasant. Does not get caught up in the unpleasant. And while not rejecting the pleasant, does not get infatuated in the pleasant. Isn't that nice? So not giving up the pleasant, not rejecting the pleasant, at the same time doesn't get infatuated. So to just see, and one of the reasons why it's so important, this thing, is that it's rather embarrassing for us sophisticated human beings who have PhDs and such things to realize that so much of what drives human behavior sometimes is a simple reaction to what's pleasant and unpleasant. And sometimes very complicated stories we make up, excuses we make up, our excuse is just to kind of justify avoiding the unpleasant or going towards the pleasant. you know, there's kind of this amoeba-like reactivity that can exist in human beings. And if you can kind of be there right at the beginning and see that there's an unpleasant situation, we recoil, unpleasant situation, we react, and just be right there and see that, then we can learn how to not be so caught in the reactivity, but just be there and let the unpleasant be the unpleasant. We don't have to do anything with it. But first you have to learn and see how often you do something, how you're not comfortable, you're not at ease just to be present for what's unpleasant. Or when things are pleasant, you do something with that. You don't just leave it alone. And so this stop and look that we do in mindfulness practice, when it applies to this ways of knowing, this basic simple ways of knowing, pleasant, unpleasant, means learning to stop, look, and stop even further. See what's going on, and then see if you can be less reactive. And if you can learn this skill of being present for what's unpleasant, and be present for what's pleasant, without being for or against it, you'll discover a lot of freedom. So much freedom that I call it a kind of a power, because then you can go into many situations and you're not going to be tricked and caught and reactive. You're just going to be there, and when you can be there that way, then you have much more access to wisdom. Then you can be wise about the situation to know how to be in it. So ways of knowing at the very beginning of how we know things, the sense data coming in. So the other category, other side, is that those sensations, those inner experiences, feelings that arise from the inside because of what's happening within us, our mental life. So if, our emotions, so it's great in meditation to sit in meditation and mind your own business and just sit there and breathe and maybe get calm and the mind gets kind of quiet. And then maybe there's a noise outside, and for some reason that noise outside reminds you of your high school boyfriend, girlfriend, who it didn't work out well. And now 40 years later, and you start feeling this inner heat and anger, and, it would have been easier just to have stayed with the sound outside, thought of it as sound or seen as pleasant or unpleasant, and just left it there. But no, your mind hasn't associated with someone from 40 years ago and what happened there and the great story and how she treated you that way or how terrible he was, and all these emotions and feelings well up. Those inner feelings of welling well up are not because of the sound, but rather because of the thoughts and the feelings, associations, memories that we have inside. And they have a whole different, but the same thing is true for them. We can learn to recognize them as pleasant and unpleasant and learn to stop, leave them alone, and see them more deeply. But that inner world, that's more kind of where what drives us, our operating principle, operating systems are operating. How the choices we make in our lives often have to do with what goes on deeper inside. And so to start noticing there's a whole other layer within us of feeling tones, of these feelings, of these kind of ways of knowing. And to learn to stop enough to really start tuning in a deeper way what's happening is part of this path to freedom. And one of the reasons we do this as part of Buddhist meditation is that some of the meditation itself creates some of these inner feelings that are pleasant. And the pleasure of meditation, the joy, the delight, the calm, the equanimity, different things that can bubble up, are not being caused by the external world, not the sense data coming in, but it has all to do with what's happening in the mind, how the mind is being shaped or trained or settled or harmonized or unified. Some of the greatest joys and pleasures, some of the ecstasy that a person can have without taking a drug, come from meditation practice. So this inner upwelling of really fantastic good feelings. And these good feelings from the inside that arise through meditation practice are something to tune into and to notice and to nourish, to support, to give space for. Because as we experience this deeper pleasure, what's inside, then this then gives a capacity for us to go even deeper into the mind, into our inner life. And one of the ways to go into deeper is to start then tuning into the third foundation of mindfulness, which is the states of our mind. And in terms of going deeper, maybe it's better to call it states of heart, the state, the quality of our hearts that we have. And I'll wait and do that next week. Next week I'll be here to talk about that. But learning to tune in to this inner life, the quality of our inner life, is what we begin to have access to when we go into these feeling tones, these ways of knowing what goes on from within. But to do that, it really helps to have learned how not to be reactive, how to be able to be still, kind of in a sense, in a kind of beautiful way, unaffected or unmoved by our experience when they're pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. As we learn to be unmoved, you know, unaffected by it, unreactive to it, then we can start having the quiet or the stillness that allows us to go deeper and deeper within. But as long as we're reactive, then we can't really go so deep. It's kind of like, you know, I don't know what, it's kind of like having, if the wind blows across the surface of the water, it agitates the water, you can't see very deep into the lake. But if the surface of the water gets quiet, then you can see what's in the depth of the lake. So the same way, you know, if we're reactive to what's going on, then we can't really see what's deeper than our reactivity, that agitation. So part of the training in Buddhism, this mindfulness tradition, is first to begin to tune into our body. Body is so important, as I said. And then comes, as we're really present in our body, it gives us access to start noticing whether things are pleasant and unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And that, if you do that, then you start noticing the difference between those sensations that are produced by the world, by the sense data coming in from the outside, and those that are welling up from the inside. Some are pleasant, some are unpleasant. And to learn to be still with those. And one of the remarkable things about this deep meditative joy or well-being that can well up, it comes from more and more letting go, more and more, less and less doing. And so it's kind of like a little bit counterintuitive. People like to desire, want, get more pleasure. It's almost like you have to want it less in order to get more of it. Isn't that great? Good luck. So we have about 10 minutes or so. If some of you would like to ask some questions about that, you're welcome to. I'll do my best to answer. Yes. And if you could say use the mic and also say your name before you ask. Say something. Just, it's nice people to hear each other's names. And
I was wondering about the joy that wells up from within and whether there's a point at which one can become infatuated with that.
Yes.
Darn.
It's usually self-correcting. If mindfulness is the kind of the primary practice you're doing, then you are noticing that infatuation. You notice the limitations, the unpleasantness of that infatuation. Mm-hmm. And so I wouldn't worry about getting infatuated because I think it's self-correcting. And sometimes a little bit of infatuation, just a little bit, is motivating and keeps you engaged and keeps you going and helps you go deeper. So you don't want to let go of infatuation. You don't, some teachers say you shouldn't even let go of attachments until they get in the way. You know, just because you're attached. I mean, Buddhism, right? You're not supposed to be attached, right? That's bad. But actually, if your attachments are helping you, stay attached. And then at some point, especially if you're being mindful, you'll notice when the attachment becomes a hindrance, a problem. And then you can let go.
Hi, Abraham. And you said mindfulness of feeling pleasant, unpleasant, and neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So I just want to hazard a guess that I think I have noticed when I'm feeling neither pleasant nor unpleasant that I want to develop a story around that, and it doesn't allow me to. So I begin to find that unpleasant. You know, I want to make a story.
Great.
Why isn't there something pleasant happening? Why isn't there something unpleasant happening? Uh-huh. My mind needs to do this in order to have a story that satisfies me.
And it's important to have stories.
Yeah. I mean, why else do we exist, right? But
so someone once said, it's a cliche, a little story, that something like, you know, the world is not made of atoms, it's made of stories.
So is there more to that? Can you just...
Yes.
Is there more to that whole neither pleasant nor unpleasant?
Oh, that way. I thought for you, the more to that for you would be, you need to get to the bottom of your story-making mind.
Yeah.
And give it a vacation.
Yeah.
You don't need to make stories. And so you maybe to understand why, when things are neither pleasant or unpleasant, you make a story. What's the nature of the reactivity? Maybe there's some aversion, there's some fear, there's some judgments going on,
sure.
Some associations with it. If you know, one of the like example of neither pleasant or unpleasant, that's socially, I think, very kind of painful for a lot of people, is if you are threatening to someone, they'll pay attention to you. If you're desirable for the person, they'll pay attention to you. But if you're neither pleasant or unpleasant for them, then you're boring for them. And they'll leave, you know, it's like, don't pay any attention to you. And that can be very painful, that, you know, someone has that judgment, you know, you're not doing anything for them. You're like, you know, no value. But to learn how to not have a story, not have a judgment, and just be with people as humans and really meet them, or to be with any situation without a story, is a great thing to learn how to do. And then maybe you can be wiser about the stories you make up, if you first have the ability not to have a story. So I think that's your task, is to get underneath what your reaction is to that, either pleasant or unpleasant, understand it better. You don't look satisfied.
More! So if the instruction is for us to note simply what is pleasant, what is unpleasant, notice our reaction to it, what is the reasoning or the rationale for noting what is neither pleasant nor unpleasant?
Because it's happening. That's all the only rationale we need in our practice is mindfulness, we're trying to be present and note, be aware of what's actually happening. And if that's the way you're knowing something in that moment, you want to just know it and keep it really simple. Yeah. It doesn't have to, and don't succumb to the belief it has to be different.
We're fighting over the microphone back here. I'm Anna Loy, and I realize this. I think maybe I haven't quite understood the difference between recognizing the reaction to external things and the things that are coming up inside of you, separate from that.
Yeah.
Because I'm thinking about a particular situation in my life where I can see myself reacting to the external stimulation. Yet at the same time, I feel all these things coming up inside me, and I realize that they're beyond or deeper than the external stimulation. So I'm not making a very clear distinction between the two, and yeah. I don't
think you need to make a clear distinction. I mean, it's okay to have a little gray zone. The two can affect each other, right? They go back and forth, and so... But I think that to try to make it simple, there's the immediate direct stimulation of our senses based on external stimuli. That's a very simple and direct. That has an impact on us, And if it impacts our associations, our judgments, our memories, our stories, then those stories get activated.
Okay.
And then they have a life of their own. Mm-hmm. And you probably had the experience of having something happen in the world. It stimulated some story, and you lost touch with the world. You were like completely now in your story, your memory, your situation. And so the inner world begins to take prominence. And I think most people, most of their experiences have very little to do with the direct external world. It's this inner world is so full and so active and such a big part of us that even when we think we're seeing the world out there, mostly we're seeing our projections and transference and all kinds of things going on. So it's a hugely important area.
Yeah.
And the quality of our hearts has a lot to do with what goes on this inside.
Yeah.
And what's beautiful to distinguish, but what's important about distinguishing the external stimuli and what goes on the inside is to become free, is to have our heart, the quality of our heart, exist independent of the situations around us. If your well-being and your quality of your heart is conditioned and dependent on what goes on in the world around you, then you're always going to be a slave to the world in a certain way. But to carry your home in your heart so that if your heart is at peace and happy, and you carry that with you, no matter where you're at, even in difficult circumstances, you keep that peace. You're free. Your heart is not being unduly affected by what goes on around. So to learn to make that distinction is important for that reason.
Thank you. That was very helpful.
Yeah, hi, my name is Chris, and I have kind of a two-part question. If I understand what you're saying, is like you observe the pleasant and the unpleasant like sort of a scientist? You're just there observing? Is that what you're saying?
You could.
Rather than in a non-attached way?
Try it. Yeah. Find some circumstances. Meditation is a great place.
Yeah.
And just spend a period of time just looking at whatever's going on for you, inner, outer, whatever's going on, and just look at it through the lens of is it pleasant or unpleasant, and your reaction to it. And see if you can just keep it really, really simple, letting the reaction go, and just stay that for a while. Keep doing it and see what happens to you.
Yeah, so it's sort of like... I like the analogy of a scientist that's, you know, is not attached to an outcome, is just experiencing what's going on so they can report on it. Okay, so the second part is I want to get some clarity on the first question that was here about the pleasant and unpleasant. I'm thinking, what about if a person is going through a long period of sadness and then they get into a pleasant experience. They observe. I don't know how you observe that without getting really attached. You know, it's.
Don't worry about being attached.
Pardon?
Then don't worry about it.
Yeah. To me, it would be rather difficult to. Just are you just saying kind of go with the flow, or?
Until it hurts so much to do so, then you can stop.
Okay.
Being too attached with joy and happiness, it'll start hurting. It'll come back and bite you.
Really?
But you can wait until it bites you.
Okay, so I'm still kind of in a quandary here.
But it's just so natural
to be drawn and to want to feel that good experience.
Yes, it's pretty natural. You have to be a little bit careful with the word natural.
Yeah.
It depends how you use the word. If you say it's natural, some people then say it's justified. There's nothing I can do about it. This is how I'm built. This has to be this way.
Yeah.
It is possible to lessen our attachments, to have less and less attachments. And I'm pretty confident that there are things that you were attached to when you were 14, 16, that you're no longer attached to. Wouldn't you say so?
Yeah, sure.
Good.
Okay. And I guess just another thing is just watch the attachment when you are attached.
It's a really central part of mindfulness practice is when you're attached, really bring careful attention to it. Notice what's, just be really present and notice it. Without analyzing it, but almost like feeling it, sensing it, feeling it. Don't give in to it, but don't reject it. It's best not to let go of attachments at the first chance you have.
Yeah.
It's good to really stay and get to know it and familiarize with it. If you let go of an attachment too quickly, you might not really understand it well enough to really understand the depth of it and what's going on and really let go in an effective way. So I think sometimes it's good to stop and observe and watch and get to know it.
Yeah. Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Okay. So I hope tonight was pleasant enough. And if it wasn't, it's your job to to be non-reactive to that. So thank you all very much.